We are a functional relationship. Then Belle sidles closer to me and tries to make out. It seems not like an act of spontaneous passion, but an attempt to prove to the others that she's the number one girlfriend. When I pull back, Belle storms away, then dances erotically on the stripper pole and makes out with Nicole. She's just doing that to get your approval, Veronica remarks dryly. Can we go home soon? And now, we are a dysfunctional relationship. Let me check with everyone else, I tell her. I'm starting to wonder if the more people there are in a relationship, the less freedom each person actually has. I talk to Belle, and of course, she wants to stay. I return to the couch and discuss it with Veronica as the swingers next to us stare at the circular table as if it's the monolith from 2001. Suddenly, Anne rolls her head softly toward me, her eyes gentle and pleading, and asks, "Can I talk to you in private?" I tell Veronica we'll be right back and walk with Anne to the entryway of the apartment. She's silent at first, as if too scared to speak, until finally the words come tumbling out. "I don't understand why you're always going like this with everybody," Anne says, agitated. To demonstrate, she grabs my left arm with surprising roughness and rubs her hands along it spastically. "In France, when people do that, it isn't just a friendly thing. It means something, so I don't understand it." She pauses and shakes her head as I try to grasp what she's saying. "At home, we just don't do this." I stand there for a moment, mystified. When her point becomes clear, my last flicker of hope dies. She's already jealous. She thinks I'm hitting on Veronica and Belle. "Everyone I'm touching, I've already slept with," I tell her. "Just like I have a relationship with you, I have a relationship with them. I explained that to you before we came, remember?" She nods yes, but she still seems displeased. It clearly wasn't the answer she was hoping for, and I'm in shock. I met Veronica at a switch club where she was fucking everyone in sight. Anne presumably knew where I went and what I was doing that night. And when I first slept with Belle, we had another woman in bed with us. I met each of them under non-monogamous circumstances and clearly told them we'd be living with two other women in a group relationship. And now every one of them, with a possible exception of Veronica, seems to want me to herself. Maybe what Randy's wife said at the dinner where I met Nicole is actually true for most people. Sexual experimentation is fun, until you're with someone you have feelings for. It's these damn feelings. They're to blame. Why is it that as soon as they descend on someone, they bring ownership with them in the passenger seat? A piece of relationship advice Lorraine taught in rehab rings ominously in my head. Unspoken expectations are premeditated resentments. When we return to the party, Belle rushes to my side. "Nicole's so hot," she says. "I've been making out with her all night." She hooks her arm in mine, and I worry that Anne will see it and get upset. "I don't know if we can do this in front of Anne," I tell her. "She needs some time to get comfortable with all the touching." Belle wheels around and stomps off again, grabbing James's arm to spite me. I'm locked in a game of emotional chess that's far out of the depth of someone who's experienced nothing but monogamy all his life. If I touch anyone, someone will get upset. But if I don't touch anyone, someone else will get upset. I feel not like a lover anymore, but a referee. It looks like the party's about to get started here, but it's not one we can actually be part of. I gather my partners and leave, trying to figure out how to create the sense of family that Orpheus Black talked about. When Anne clambers into the front seat without checking with the other women, who exchange peevish glances, I console myself with the thought that maybe we're actually acting like a typical family. Back at the house, I visit Veronica in her room and bid her goodnight. "Come back," she implores. I tell her I'll try. Then I visit Belle. "This isn't working for me," she complains. "I want to be able to touch you when I want." We need to stick together as a team to make this work, I remind her. I'm a girl, and I have emotions, she responds. And though my head says we're a team, I still want to be with only you. And then I visit Anne. But when she asks me to stay for a little while, I look at her lying there, starved for connection and reassurance after her long trip, and give in. It's only fair. I've already slept once with each of the others. As I remove her clothes, I'm excited to feel once more the runner's legs, swimmer's abs, and ballerina's breasts she keeps hidden beneath her formless clothes. Still, I can't spend the night because that will hurt the other girls. When I break the news a while later, Anne inquires simply, Have you ever felt true love before? It's an odd non sequitur, so I tell her, I've been in love, but true love? What's the difference? True love is when you're a mother and your daughter is born. It's that much love, and you feel it all the time. So it's feeling that way every second of every day forever? Yes, you're so in love that you don't want to be with other people. I don't know, I reply. Have you ever felt true love before? Not before I met you. My blood freezes. I thought this was just sweet pillow talk. I can't believe she's gotten that attached so quickly. I've invited an addict here. A love junkie, connecting in a fog of fantasy. When you're a mother, I tell her, and your second child is born, you still feel just as much love as when your first child was born. I speak as slowly as possible, so she'll understand. It's not a sign of true love when you only want to feel it with one person who you just met and don't really know yet. That's more like obsession. She's silent. Do you understand? Yes, she says, kissing me tenderly. I understand. And I hope she does. I walk upstairs and search the closets for extra blankets, but all I can find is a single spare sheet. I grab it and check the living room couch to see if it unfolds into a bed. Unfortunately, it doesn't. So I toss the back cushions onto the floor to make a little more room, lie on the narrow couch, and spread the sheet over myself. It's cold, cramped, and uncomfortable. The only thing keeping me warm is my frustration. I'm living with three women I'm dating, and I'm spending the night alone on the couch. This is most definitely the last thing I thought I'd be doing in my father-yoed dream house. Chapter 30. As soon as I wake up, I place an emergency call to Pepper, explain the situation I'm in, and beg for advice. You're trying to run before you can walk, he responds. What do you mean? How many people are in the house? Four of us. So mathematically, that's six relationships, and it's hard enough to make one relationship work. I had thought of it as a single relationship, or three at most, but I do the math, the Gauss formula of polyamory, and he's right. But there was this guy, Father Yod, I protest, who had 14 wives, and it worked for him, I think. I realize I don't know much about how Father Yod managed his relationships. In fact, I never actually read the book Rick showed me. I just looked at the pictures. Who's Father Yod? Pepper asks. He's like Charles Manson, but without the killing. Actually, that's not totally true. I recall reading online afterward that Father Yod was a judo expert who murdered two people with his bare hands in self-defense. What I can tell you is that a shared living situation is what we call an advanced skill, Pepper explains. But trust me, it can work. I just went on a week-long vacation to Hawaii with my partner and her boyfriend, and it was totally smooth because the three of us had spent so much time together. Right now, I can't see us ever getting to that point, I tell him. I suppose after a few years, one can get used to anything. Do you want me to come by and talk to them? He offers. Please. When Pepper arrives an hour later, we gather in the living room, desperate for a miracle. I dare not sit on the couch, in case it looks like I'm favoring whichever woman drops down next to me, so I take an armchair instead. Veronica and Pepper sit in the other chairs, while Belle and Anne share the couch. I introduce Pepper to the women and tell him about the previous night. He listens carefully, then responds, as if telling preschoolers to play nicely with one another. Unlike with monogamy, our culture offers no schooling on how to make a group relationship work, no real role models to look up to, and few, if any, friends to turn to for advice. Even in movies, when couples decide to open their marriage, the results are usually disastrous, and the moral of the story is to stick with what you've got. "Here's your first lesson in going out together," he begins. His voice is so slow and measured that it's hard to imagine anything short of a machete-wielding maniac ruffling him. I wonder if he was always this calm and deliberate, or if it's something he learned from years of managing multiple relationships. "You need to talk before you leave," he continues, "and have a plan for party protocol. If someone gets tired, do they take a cab home alone, or do you all leave together? And if it's a sexual situation, decide ahead of time whether you want to watch or leave or join the sex pile." This makes perfect sense, yet it never occurred to me. The art of group relationships is logistics. "I want to encourage you," he continues, "to do little check-ins with one another constantly, with the knowledge that you don't know each other very well. This way, you can start to build a team feeling together." We nod in agreement. I suppose I was naive to assume we would all just instantly become attached and live in relational utopia together. I've made mistakes in every monogamous relationship I've had, but I learned from them, and that made the next relationship better. So it makes sense that my first multiple partner relationship isn't going to be a runaway success. It takes experience and failure to get good at anything. This is my opportunity to learn. "I want to add something that's important," Pepper continues. "You," he points to me, "are the fulcrum." This is a long-known poly situation. The fulcrum is the only person in a relationship with each partner. But because of that, you end up torn in a lot of different directions. It's a very uncomfortable thing, because you're empowered and disempowered at the same time. He turns to the women. "So I would like to recommend that you all try to de-center Neil a little." I heave a hopefully imperceptible sigh of relief. I watched several documentaries on poly pods before coming here, and many were led by people with a pathological need to be the focal point of everyone's love. They didn't seem to care whose feelings got hurt as long as the empty space in their own heart was kept filled. But for me, it's no fun being the center of attention when it results in collateral damage to other people's feelings. "So how do we decenter me?" I ask Pepper. "The three of you," he gestures to the women, "should hang out without him, and also start negotiating decisions that don't have to go through him first. The easy part of the situation is you and Neil, and you and Neil, and you and Neil." Here he points to each woman. "The hard part of the situation is your relationships with each other. I have a saying, poly works or fails on trust between metamors." "What's a metamor?" Veronica asks. "A metamor is a partner's partner. So if Neil and I were both dating you, then Neil would be my metamor. And it succeeds between him and me, because we have the hard part, but not the good stuff. So when you build trust among metamors, everything comes together, and the group starts functioning. Does that make sense?" We were in the dark before. This pale goth guy is the light. He's a relationship pioneer, mapping new realms in interpersonal space. "So what do I do if I want to spend time with Neil alone?" Belle asks. "Every time I try to do that, he says it's rude to someone else." Try not making that request to Neil, Pepper responds. Make it to Anne and Veronica, and if they both say it's okay, then you can do whatever you want with Neil. The corners of Belle's mouth turn up in an unsuccessfully repressed smile. Pepper spots this and adds sagely, but be willing to hear a no. Veronica sighs and uncrosses her legs. It's so hard to share a person, she says. It would be easier if we didn't have strong feelings, but there's always going to be this mental fight to have him. Although having three attractive women fighting over me may seem like an ego trip, in reality, it's nerve-shattering. Whatever interest they had in me before they arrived seems to have been exacerbated by the competition. According to a copy of O Magazine I once read in Sheila's waiting room, polygamous men lived 9 years longer, on average, than monogamous men. But I wonder how Oprah could possibly be right, because this is definitely not good for my blood pressure. Pepper turns to me. What you can do to get them past that point is reassure them. I've seen really jealous people, and people with a lot of abandonment issues, get past their shit once the fear of loss goes away. A good non-monogamous group is like a flock of geese, which is to say it separates and comes back together. Anne opens her mouth to speak. The words escape soft and unsure. Everyone leans in to make sure they catch them. For me, I was really surprised last night, because when everybody was touching, it was hurting me. She takes a pause so long it seems like an intermission. I have a complicated family history, so maybe I get more possessive. But I understand now that we have to make things work so this can be a relationship. Pepper's talk seems to be straightening everyone out. The Metamores are remembering that they didn't come here to be in some bachelor-like competition, but to live, learn, and grow in a mature relationship together. I would recommend letting go of expectations and trying to get to a place of acceptance with everything, Pepper tells her. If things get weird, let them be weird. If you can all get to a high communication level and learn the process of negotiation and setting boundaries and talking through discomfort, this will start working much better for all of you. Before Pepper leaves, the four of us agree to hold house meetings every day, during which each person will get a turn to speak uninterrupted, like in the talking stick circle I made fun of in rehab. As a sense of calm and understanding descends on the house afterward, Veronica makes egg salad sandwiches, and we sit around the table, all on the same page for the first time. Then, with Anne taking the front seat of the car without incident, we visit Alcatraz. As we walk from the ferry to the island prison, Belle holds my left arm while Anne clutches the other. Veronica wanders behind, taking photos. I feel like I'm a third child whose mother doesn't have enough hands to hold, Veronica says as she catches up to us. She takes Anne's hand in hers as a group of frat boys walks by and gives me a thumbs up. For the first time, there's a group energy connecting us. Perhaps all of us just needed to let go of our expectations, like Pepper recommended, adjust to being somewhere new, and allow the relationship to set its own course. And that's when something unexpected happens. I'm overcome by a powerful sense of unworthiness. It doesn't seem fair that these women have to share me. Any one of them could easily have her pick of the guys here who keep looking at us. But instead, they're settling for scraps of my affection, the crumbs of a crumb. When I imagined living in a freewheeling love commune while I was dating Ingrid, I thought I'd be adrift in a blissful sea of pleasure, excitement, and feminine energy. But instead, I feel embarrassed that I'm monopolizing three hearts. I spent my childhood starved for my mother's and babysitter's love, feeling like most of their positivity went to my brother and their negativity to me. So being in a position where I'm actually getting so much positive female caring is a new experience. Maybe the real purpose of this quad relationship for me is to break through my walls and feel worthy of love, or whatever this is. Chapter 31. In the car on the way home, I tell the girls that Nicole and James invited us to a play party called Kinky Salon, where a swinger party is generally for couples looking to swap. A play party is basically any hosted alt-sex event where people get together to throw down. And Kinky Salon is one of the most playful parties of them all. A cool, creative scene with beautiful women, costumed hipsters, and no creep factor. Is everyone comfortable going? I ask. I'm going to stay home, Anne says. It's the same thing she said in France. And secretly, I'm grateful. Since Pepper's talk, she seems to have left her love addiction haze and accepted our quadness. And now, finally, we are a flock of geese. Even Veronica and Belle appear to be getting along. As soon as we get home, Belle asks her, "Can I dress you? You're so pretty, and I have some clothes you'll love." The compliment appears to be a sincere attempt to connect. And since women trying on one another's clothing is a universal sign of sisterhood, I leave them alone to bond. Maybe they just needed time and Pepper's reassurance to get comfortable with each other rather than feeling forced to be friends. When they reemerge, Veronica is wearing a fitted pink and white striped dress with a plunging neckline and a black leather corset. She looks stunning, so Belle gets the front seat as a reward for her generosity. It's still ridiculous, I know. Appropriately, Kinky Salon is throwing a harem-themed party. When we arrive at the warehouse apartment with James and Nicole, we see men wearing turbans and smoking hookahs, while women in veils and gold lame bras sit in their laps, fucking them as Arabic music pipes softly through the rooms. At every party I've been to so far, the women seem to be in control of when the action starts and with whom. But once things are underway, they tend to play submissive roles. I don't see any sultanesses, for example, worshipped by harem boys. The back room is like a low-rent version of the French switch club. It's full of mattresses pushed together, but instead of a free-for-all, people are clustered in twosomes and threesomes. As we sit and watch, Belle whispers to me, "Why don't you and Veronica have sex?" "Do you want to join us if she's open to it?" I ask. "I don't think she likes me that much." "Go ahead. I'll get you later." "Are you sure? I can't believe this is happening. It's practically a miracle. In fact, I'll go out on a limb and say it is a miracle. The poly gods have smiled on us today." "I'm sure." Between Pepper's pep talk and the lack of alcohol in her bloodstream, Belle's another person tonight. I leave her with Nicole and James, then lead Veronica to the only unoccupied spot on the mattress pile, which is just a few feet away from a woman impaled on the lap of a man in a purple turban. Soon, Veronica's on top of me, riding herself to orgasm after orgasm, her lips parted ecstatically, her back arched electrically, her hips pursuing perfect rhythm and pressure, and both of us, once again, enjoying the rapture we last experienced together in Paris. When we rejoin the group, Belle rushes to my side and asks, "Can I spend the night with you tonight?" "So that was your plan." "It seems reasonable, but then I think, what about Anne?" I check my phone and there's a text from her. "Need and would love to spend the night with you." Now what? I can't spend the night with Anne because Belle would be upset. And I can't spend it with Belle because Anne will be hurt. And I can't spend it with Veronica because then both Belle and Anne will be angry. It is the polyamorist's paradox. And anyway, didn't Pepper tell them they were supposed to negotiate this with one another, not with me? I explain the situation privately to James and ask what he recommends doing. He shakes his head and grimaces. There's no right answer. I tried dating another girl with Nicole, and a similar thing happened. You want these multiple relationships, but you just end up hurting everybody. It's a lot of work. The amount of communication it takes is exhausting, and someone always feels left out. I'm relieved to hear it's not just me who has these problems, that this would likely have happened with any women I chose to live with, unless they were very poly-experienced. I guess swinging works, I tell him, because all the women you're sleeping with are in other relationships, so they're not a threat to your partner. Exactly, he says, smiling. It's polyamory light. As we gather our partners and leave, James sizes me up for a moment, as if deciding whether I deserve whatever favor he's about to bestow. Then he puts his arm around me and whispers, I want you to meet a friend of ours named Reed Mihalko. He's the Yoda of sex parties. If anyone can help these women loosen up and get on the same page, it's him. Back at the apartment, I make the rounds. I tuck everybody in, discuss how they're feeling, and help them understand why I can't spend the night with them. Then I settle in for another uncomfortable night on the couch. It was a good day, the best yet, but I'm still sleeping on the sofa. However, unlike the night before, this time I'm sleeping with hope. We made huge strides forward today. And if Reed Mihalko is even half as experienced and helpful as Pepper, this whole crazy idea just might actually work. Chapter 32. The next morning, the Metamores follow more of Pepper's advice and have an adventure without me. Nicole picks them up and takes them shopping, then treats them to a fancy brunch. And just as Pepper predicted, they return brimming with positive energy and a surprising sense of camaraderie. I'm starting to become decentered. They also return with an extra body. He's a broad-shouldered, large-skulled, gentle giant with sandy blonde hair, wireframe glasses, and large teeth. He's wearing jeans and a slightly undersized purple t-shirt stretched across his paunchy belly with the words Sex Geek emblazoned on it. Meet Reed Mihalko, Nicole announces. Reed, she explains, is one of the leading figures in San Francisco's sex-positive scene. He has slept with, by his own estimation, 1,000 men and women, and he teaches courses on everything from kissing to pegging, which is when a woman puts on a strap-on and inserts it in a man. I've come here on a mission, he says. James told me everything. He speaks slowly and rakishly, with one corner of his mouth rising higher than the other. He's a cross between Clark Kent, John Malkovich, and someone recovering from a mild stroke. He says he wants to observe us checking in, and then he has something important to discuss. We take our seats in the living room. As usual, I choose a chair just to be safe. For the first time, every check-in is positive. Belle says she had an epiphany last night at Kinky Salon that relationships are about giving, not getting. Anne explains that her mind and heart are starting to open to this experience, and even Veronica has warmed up. The vibe isn't so tense anymore, she says. I feel like we're actually connected and can learn from each other now, so I'm very happy about that. I really liked last night, and I would like to do it sometime more, yes? She laughs. When we're finished, Reed asks us to take a deep breath and exhale loudly. It reminds me of something Sheila would do. Then, in a very slow, didactic voice, he tells us, aside from doing cuddle parties, which are non-sexual workshops around touch and affection, I have been throwing play parties and creating spaces for adults to be able to frolic and explore their sexuality since 1999. And this evening, I'm throwing a play party for a friend who's staying with me and who hasn't had sex in a year. My objective is to get her laid. and we're having about 30 people come over to hang out and play, whatever that looks like for them. So I'm here to determine, one, if it's good for you all as a group, and two, if it's a good idea for my community. I want to create a space that feels safe and genuine because I specialize in those kind of dynamics. Once again, I'm in debt to James and Nicole. Where Pepper helped us negotiate the emotional boundaries, it seems that Reed is here to help us negotiate the physical ones. Reed then asks each of us a series of questions designed to open us up to positive experiences that we've been denying ourselves. What are you afraid to ask other people for? What don't you think you deserve? If you could experience anything in your next few days together, what would it be? They are the right questions, and they allow each metamor to be heard and feel understood rather than judged. Soon, Belle is talking about wanting to have sex with two men, and Veronica is saying she wants to be fucked by a girl with a strap on. Even Anne, in her own way, says she wants to join in. I want to feel free together, without being hurt. I suppose this is yet another female dilemma. To feel free to follow the cravings of one's heart and body without being hurt or shamed afterward. I've never met a man who didn't want to experience his sexual fantasies in real life. Yet I've met many women who've said they wouldn't be comfortable actually experiencing the scenarios they masturbate to. And what about you? Reed asks me. What are your intentions for the next few days? All I want, I tell him, is for the three of us to laugh a lot, enjoy our days together, and then sleep in the same bed comfortably. Can you be more precise? Is there anything you'd like specifically to happen in that bed? You know, it doesn't even matter. That's my hope for us. Probably more so now that I'm sleeping on the couch every night. Thank you. He looks each of us in the eyes appreciatively. It's difficult to tell whether he's genuinely connecting or performing a rehearsed gesture, but either way, it works. My invitation for each of you, he says, is to spend more time asking for what you want rather than asking everyone else what they want. You will speed up your growth by being selfish. So imagine that the people you're looking at can actually take care of themselves, and if you ask for what you want and trust that the other person will say yes or no powerfully, it will make things very interesting. Life is a learned skill, but instead of teaching it, our culture force-fills developing minds with long division in capital cities until, at the end of the mandatory period of bondage that's hyperbolically called school, we're sent into the world knowing little about it. And so, left on our own to figure out the most important parts of life, we make mistakes for years, until, by the time we've learned enough from our stumbling to be effective human beings, it's time for us to die. In other words, if I hadn't met teachers like Pepper and Reed, who have at least excelled in one area of this short pilgrimage toward the grave, I would have given up on this quad and the possibility of one ever working. But I now see my responsibility for the problems we've been having. As usual, I've been trying to please everyone and sacrificing my own needs. And that's not what I broke up with Ingrid to do. In fact, in trying to take care of everybody, I ended up taking care of nobody. I glance at Nicole, and she nods back at me as if she's reading my mind. Reed takes a long breath and exhales enthusiastically. It's not a sigh so much as it is a display. If I were to invite you all, he says, to come to the play party, raise your hand if you would like to go. Everyone's hands go up, even, ever so meekly, Anne's. Chapter 33. When we leave for Reed's house in Oakland, several hours later, Anne clambers into the queen position in the car as if it's hers by right. I make a mental note to talk to her about it at the next house meeting. We then pick up Nicole, who went back to her apartment to shower and change. "Is James coming?" I ask when she scoots into the back seat, wearing a black silk blouse and a tight gray skirt. "No, he has to work," she says. My quad has turned into a pentagram. "Let's discuss party protocol," I suggest, taking Pepper's advice. The car is crawling through typical San Francisco traffic, so we have plenty of time to negotiate. Nicole speaks first. "I can only watch because James and I have a rule that we only play together. It seems their relationship has gotten more restrictive since she broke the rules in the laundry room. Trust is a chain that gets longer the less you pull on it." "For me," Veronica says, "everyone can do whatever they want. I don't mind." "Same here," Belle adds. "As long as Neil doesn't have sex with anyone in front of me." When I met Belle, I had sex with another woman in front of her, and she didn't mind. But that was when she thought she'd never see me again. According to evolutionary theory, it's supposed to be men who are wired to get more upset when a woman has sex with someone else because his genes won't be passed on if he raises children who aren't his. Women have supposedly evolved to get more upset when a man has an emotional affair because of the fear of losing his support and protection. Of course, we have DNA testing and economic independence now, so evolution needs to catch up. "You can all do whatever you want also," I tell them. The only person who hasn't checked in is Anne, who's wearing polyester slacks, flat black shoes, a stiff button-down shirt, and a giant navy blue shawl. She looks aggressively unsexy. "What are your boundaries tonight?" I repeat the question for her. She stares out the window for a minute, as if she doesn't hear, then, without turning, responds, "I'm not comfortable." "Not comfortable with what?" She speaks so softly that the metamors in the back seat lean forward to hear. "With you having sex?" It takes a few seconds for the words to register. Then they hit me like a blackjack. "With Belle and Veronica?" I ask. "Or with the other people there?" Everything seemed to be going so well today. "With anyone." "For Christ's sake. At the house meeting this afternoon, we told you where we were going and what we would be doing there. You raised your hand and said you wanted to go. And now you're changing the rules?" That's what I want to say. Instead, I try not to react. Where there is reactivity, there is a wound. It seems they were right about everything in sex addiction therapy, except the sex part. I scroll through my brain, searching for the right response. I try to follow Reed's advice, to speed up my growth by being selfish, and see Anne as an adult who can take care of herself. My goal here is to be honest, to allow discomfort, to communicate openly. She needs to be prepared to accept a no. "I can't promise you what will or won't happen tonight," I tell her. "I might just lie there and watch people and do nothing. Or I might have sex with everyone. I have no idea." Anne doesn't respond. "Do you still want to go if that happens?" I ask her. Silence. Maybe she's scrolling through her brain for the right response. Or maybe she's shutting down. She mumbles something. "What?" Mumble. "Can you say that louder?" I'm fighting to stay in the functional adult. Finally, she says, "If it happens, then I want to go home." "Back to the house?" "Back to France." I thought the French were open-minded, liberal, and tolerated affairs. I thought Anne knew what was happening when I went to those clubs. I clearly need to stop assuming that anything is true. "Would you be more comfortable," I ask her, "if I limited myself to just kissing or cuddling at the party?" "No," she says. The mood in the car dims as each of our fantasies for the night smash like a flock of geese against a picture window. This is beyond even my worst-case scenario for our free love group relationship. Now I can't even hold someone's hand at a fucking orgy? Irritation creeps into my voice. Before you came here, I told you we'd be living with two other girlfriends and going to sex parties like the one I went to in Paris. So you have to understand that I can't just pretend like I'm only going to be with you. And she's mute again. I look at Nicole beseechingly, my eyes flashing a distress signal. There are many people, Nicole explains patiently, who don't believe it's natural for them to be with one person for the rest of their lives. They believe that their sexuality shouldn't be owned or controlled by someone else, and that if they have sex with another person, it doesn't change the way they feel about their partner. These are the kind of people who are going to be at this party. Anne doesn't react, so Nicole continues. Think about it this way. When people have friends, they have different kinds of relationships with each of them. Even if they have a best friend, that doesn't mean they can't have other friends. And that's the way the people at this party think of sexual relationships. After a long, uncomfortable silence, during which she appears to come to some sort of decision, Anne turns to face me. In Paris, we connected on this level. She points to her head, her heart, and her crotch. But this time, my feelings for you are different. My body and mind are changing. I don't exactly understand her point, but it sounds like she's breaking up with me in her own way, which is a relief. I feel the same way, I tell her. You're a beautiful person inside and outside, but we're very different and want different things. So maybe it's best if we're just friends. When I say this, her face falls. Evidently, I misunderstood. What's wrong? I ask. I said my feelings for you have changed. I know. They've gotten stronger. And now, my face falls. Chapter 34. I gave up having sex at the party last night, and today it's my turn. Belle vents as we approach Reed's loft. I'm tired of everyone. She searches for the word. Vag blocking. This is my chance to stop taking care of everyone else's needs and focus on my own. Anne and I never agreed to be exclusive. The deal was that we'd be in a group relationship, so she's the one breaking the rules. For the first time, I'm going to do exactly what I told the guys in rehab that we should do. Train a partner to accept a relationship on our terms, rather than us accepting it on theirs. And most importantly, to do it honestly. Here's what I suggest, I tell Anne. There's going to be a welcome circle where everyone talks about their expectations for the party. And I suggest leaving the room after the welcome circle. If you want to know later whether I did anything, you can ask me, and I'll tell you the truth. She nods in a direction that looks like yes. It's clear she's still not completely comfortable, but those are her emotions to worry about, not mine. I can't get enmeshed here. We walk into Reed's loft. It's a large square space with a stage in the front, a huge carpet in the middle, a balcony that wraps around three of the walls, and a crowd best described as pansexual. Straight men, gay men, bi men, bi women, butch lesbians, lipstick lesbians, and probably no completely straight woman, other than maybe Anne. We settle in a corner next to a man who introduces himself as Reed's building superintendent. He's there with a woman he describes as his mostly lesbian girlfriend and her female lover. Only in the Bay Area would someone's maintenance man also be poly and into sex parties. Now I understand why Nicole encouraged me to rent a place here. We are in a free territory where the sexual revolution has already been fought and won. As Nicole busily texts James, Reed runs the welcome circle. He lectures first on safe sex, then on how to ask for permission to touch someone, and finally, on how to be comfortable saying no. He asks us to practice the following dialogue with our neighbors. Orgy Participant 1, can I blank you? Orgy Participant 2, no. Orgy Participant 1, thank you for taking care of yourself. Supposedly, no one is born with greatness. It takes, the theory goes, 10,000 hours of experience to master something. And Reed has clearly put in his 10,000 hours of orgies. By the time he finishes his lecture, which serves as foreplay in the same way deity worship did at the puja, everyone feels safe, comfortable, and ready to free their libidos from their socially strung corsets. Everyone, that is, except Anne and Nicole. Do you know what time we're leaving? Nicole asks. I don't know, really. We just got here. Because if it's going to take more than an hour, I'll have James come pick me up. I don't understand why she came all the way here with us if she wanted to go home right away. I doubt it'll be longer than an hour, I tell her. But I'm not sure. I don't even know what's about to happen. I'm getting overwhelmed. Fuck, why does it matter? James is nervous that I'm here. Then why did you come? He said it was okay as long as I didn't play with anyone. So then, don't play with anyone. I know, but he's upset because he feels left out. So I just want to go home soon, okay? So far, not a single alternative relationship that I've closely observed appears to be free, intimate, and healthy. In the sex addiction community, they wanted us to control our bodies so our hearts could connect. In this community, they want us to control our hearts so our bodies can connect. But maybe expecting to have it all, the deepest intimacy and the most unrestrained lust, is an unrealistic quest, like expecting a human being to be perfect. All you can do is work to get as close as possible to the impossible. After instructing the assemblage to take a deep breath, Reed concludes the welcome circle by asking his guests what they want to experience during the play party. I want to watch the couple next to me have sex. I want to make out with every woman here for 7 minutes each. I want another woman to use a strap-on on me. I want to go down on my boyfriend with another guy. Anne sits still next to me. She's not so much holding my hand as she's clutching onto it for dear life. Do you want to leave? I ask her when the welcome circle ends. Silence. A woman in front of us removes her girlfriend's shirt and buries her face and breasts. A guy behind us takes off his pants. He's wearing tidy blackies and knee-high black socks. An avalanche is rolling toward Anne's psyche. You should really leave right now, I warn her. Two women who are with Knee Sock Man begin removing their clothes. A sex pile is forming. I call Reed over. He's the Yoda of orgies. He'll know what to do. You always have to go with the person who has the least amount of comfort, he advises. So if you have to sit here and just watch, then that's what you have to do. I'm confused by his advice. It seems like the exact opposite of what he said at the house this afternoon about being selfish. Maybe he doesn't understand the situation. But what's not fair, I tell him, is that she doesn't want anyone else to touch me or hold my hand, yet she does those things with me. I sound like I'm in kindergarten. And she knew that she was coming here to be in a group relationship. If that's the case, he replies, then she needs to understand that you're not exclusive with her and that you need to take care of yourself and she needs to take care of herself. He did a total 180 again. Now I have no idea what's right. My moral compass has lost true north. I have to look inward for answers. My functional adult says I should suck it up and do nothing so I don't hurt this wilting flower. But my inner child wants to play. He's tired of being held back by the emotions of the people around him. I watch enviously as the guy with the knee-high socks enjoys his threesome. Their bodies, hands, and tongues artfully slide across one another in myriad shifting positions, each one natural, effortless, creative. This picture was what I'd hoped to step into with the house here. In his case, it's clear the women are more into each other than him, and maybe that's why it's working so well. Meanwhile, Anne is desperately clinging to me like a stop sign for fun. Belle is whispering sexual enticements in my ear, Nicole is asking when we can go, and Veronica is sitting in a chair, either sulking or just being herself. I feel like I'm wearing a spiked suit. Any move I make is going to hurt someone. This is the moment of poly truth. I need to man up and take charge. I need to be Orpheus Black. I need to channel Kamala Devi. I need to get Father Yoda on them. My problem this whole time is that I've been trying to rule by consensus, and every large group relationship I've seen or even heard about has been run by, as Kamala put it, a benevolent dictator. These girls are looking for a daddy. So as loathsome as that whole dynamic is, maybe it's time to step up and be that daddy. Not the abandoning daddy or the enmeshing daddy, but the functional daddy with a sense of what's right. And what's not right is that Anne is violating the agreements she made and the rights of the other women in the group to also have a relationship with me. Nicole, take Anne to the car, I order. They can wait in my apartment if they want, the building superintendent offers. How much longer do you think he'll be? Nicole asks me as he zips up his pants and leaves them out. As long as it takes, I tell her. Veronica remains seated in the chair. She had her turn last night. Fair is fair. I once spoke to Barbara Williamson, a co-founder of Sandstone Retreat, one of the most famous swinger meccas of the 70s, and she said that she was introduced to the lifestyle shortly after her wedding when her husband fucked another woman in front of her. Although it was painful in the moment, after she saw that it didn't affect the relationship in any way, she realized it wasn't such a big deal. Maybe I should have slept with each of the women in front of the others on the day Anne arrived, just to get the pain and possessiveness over with for everyone. I take Belle's hand, and we walk through the orgy, drinking in the spectacle. Unlike the parties I've been to so far, here the lights aren't even dimmed. There is no shame. And though the couples look more like the ones at the polyamory conference, the scene is as beautiful as the one at Bliss. That's when I understand that it's not physical beauty that makes these parties pretty or ugly. It's honest and open intentions. Hypocrisy is ugly. Upstairs, there's a fucking machine. Not a fucking machine, but a fucking machine. A dildo powered by a piston engine. An Asian girl lies in front of it as a large hippie woman I recognize from the polyamory conference turns it on, then massages the girl's breasts as she gets robo-fucked. Nearby, a couple is rolling around the room, having sex in a large circular ball with stirrups and hand grips. Reed's Loft is like an amusement park for horny adults. And as exciting as it is, it's hard to focus. The longer we walk around, the guiltier I feel about Anne and Nicole. Even if they did renege on the plan, it was still inconsiderate of me to just banish them like some sort of orgy despot. People are allowed to change their minds. A woman with black hair latches onto Belle and asks permission to kiss her. They start making out, but as soon as I get turned on, Belle breaks away and tells her, "Where's your boyfriend? You should go find him." She wants me to herself, even at an orgy. Belle drags me to a spot along the balcony. 20 feet away, Reed is fucking a cute indie rocker woman. Belle and I make out as I rub her to wetness. Then she unbuttons my pants and goes down on me. Once I'm hard, she stands up, turns away from me, and grips the railing of the loft balcony, her ass in the air. As I put on a condom, I start thinking about Anne again. I worry that she's suffering in the superintendent's apartment, picturing me in the middle of a sex pile. Next to her, Nicole's probably stressed out on the phone, getting yelled at by James for staying here without him. And I feel like a selfish prick. I can't believe I actually kicked them out of Reed's apartment, just so they wouldn't get in the way of my fun. Last night, Veronica and I had permission. Tonight, Belle and I don't. I notice a nearby couple watching. Even people downstairs seem to be looking up. It feels like their eyes are judging us, accusing us of violating poly protocol. The chair Veronica was sitting in is empty. I scan the room for her, but she's not in sight. So either she decided to participate, or she also got mad and left the loft. I feel drawn and quartered emotionally. I shut my eyes, take a deep breath, and try to focus on the smooth, pale, shapely body part in front of me. I thrust once and imagine it penetrating Anne's heart like a dagger. I thrust a second time, and her heart breaks. I thrust again, and there's nothing left of her, just an empty shell. I thrust halfway and think that if Anne ever does chair work, this would be on her list of traumas. I can't go on. I pull out, and it's completely soft. I stagger back into a desk chair, and Belle tries to perform genital CPR. But it's dead. I feel too guilty, I tell her. She doesn't speak. The look on her face says enough. It's not anger or sadness. It's the look of a child pouting. It's not fair. In a sudden flash of clarity, I see the truth. I made the wrong decision. When Reed said to be selfish, he wasn't giving me permission to hurt people's feelings. He was giving me permission to ask for what I wanted. And it wasn't Anne who needed to be comfortable hearing a no. It was Belle and me, because the person in a relationship with the least amount of comfort does get to set the boundaries, even if she keeps changing the rules and putting on blinders to what's really happening. Anne heard what she wanted to hear so she could be here in San Francisco with me, and in the same way, I heard what I wanted to hear so I could have my free love harem. I'm just as bad as she is. Maybe we do belong together. And so I sit, surrounded by pleasure, descending into a giant shame spiral. Guilt is about what you do with your dick. Shame is about being a dick. Let's just go, I groan, defeated. Fine. Belle trails behind me resentfully. When we reach the bottom of the stairs, Nicole runs up to us in a panic. I've been trying to find you. Everyone's really upset. Everyone or Anne? Everyone. And Anne is in a lot of pain. That's what I was afraid of. Being selfish and having a conscience are not a good combination. It's like having a gun with bullets that no matter which direction they're fired in, always end up hitting you in the head. I should have just let James come get me, Nicole vents as she rushes us to the front door. He's freaking out. Leaving Reed's apartment, we see Veronica in the hallway, walking briskly toward us. Her eyes lock on mine, then turn away in disgust. I thought I was tough, she says bitterly, but you really have no feelings. Her words send me deeper into my shame spiral. When I take care of everyone else in the relationship, I'm miserable. When I take care of myself, I'm still miserable. I can't see any way to make this work. This is the worst orgy of my life. And maybe that's the problem. I shouldn't be dragging my quad around to play parties. That's exactly what a sex addict would do. I'm sure Father Yod didn't need to take his wives to sex parties. They had everything they needed at home. Even if I'm going in all the way, the point is to commit to a more open relationship, not to pleasing every carnal urge. At the very least, caring, understanding, and trust need to be established first. Impatience is the enemy of intimacy. Belle and I walk with Nicole and Veronica to the super's apartment like inmates to a courtroom. Do I have to go inside? Belle asks as we get close. Yes, you do. Maybe you should walk in ahead of me, though, so we're not arriving together and rubbing it in. A criticism Rick once gave me flashes through my mind. You create the image that you're a good person, as opposed to actually being a good person. I wait outside a few more seconds, then enter. The first thing I see is Anne, sitting on the floor, wrapped deeply in her shawl. She looks like one of those children pulled by police from under a bed after having witnessed the brutal murder of her parents. I apologize to her, and she says nothing. As we walk to the car, Belle darts ahead and positions herself in front of the passenger door. "Come on," I tell her, exasperated, showing too little consideration too late. "Be respectful of Anne and let her sit in the front." The stupid fucking front seat. The modern automobile was clearly designed by monogamists. Night has fallen, but it is not as dark as the mood in the car as we drive back to San Francisco. Pepper said that the goal was to decenter me, and I feel in this moment like I truly have lost my center. I have no idea what to say or how to navigate this. "Does anyone want to check in?" I ask feebly. No one says a word, not even Nicole. "I'll begin then," I speak to the silence. "In short, I made the wrong decision here, and I..."
"You made the wrong decision," Belle snaps. "Why?"
Fuck, now I've made it worse. Belle thinks I'm saying that I made a mistake by choosing to be with her. "Maybe there was no right decision," I continue. All week, we've managed to survive by making sure everyone was comfortable, even if that meant some of us not getting what we wanted. But Reed told us in the house that we should be selfish, that everyone will take care of themselves if you take care of yourself. I'm babbling now, making excuses. And maybe I should have just gone with what I felt, but he seemed to know what he was saying, so it just really threw me off.
"You should maybe think for yourself instead of doing what other people tell you," Veronica pipes in icily.
She's absolutely right. Mean, but right. I'm losing it. It's hard enough hurting one person in a monogamous relationship, but today I've hurt four people. Polyamory is not just about having room in one's heart for more love. It's also about having room for more pain and guilt. If love hurts, then polyamory kills. "I don't think this works," I continue, "if people aren't considerate of others, and I violated that today. I really crossed a line. I sound like a murderer trying to talk a victim's family into feeling sorry for him. I'm sorry, Anne, and also sorry, Belle. Sorry, everybody. That's my check-in." I heave a deep sigh.
"Same emotion," Belle says. "That's my check-in."
"Veronica, is there anything you want to say?" I ask, remembering how communication has saved us in the past.
"No."
Her voice is flat and passionless. Even communication can't help us now.
"Anne?"
Silence. The only woman still talking to me in the car is the GPS navigation system, who speaks for all of us when she says, "Recalculating." "No more sex parties, okay?" I say. "I don't even care if we have any more sex. How would you guys feel if we just spent the rest of this time trying to get to know each other better?" No one replies. Anne stares through the passenger window silently, her senses registering nothing, flatlined, the embodiment of Henry from Rehab's mysterious ninth emotion, the death feeling. In that moment, I hate her. I hate her for not saying anything. I hate her for silently suffering, just like my mom. I hate her for not listening to a word we said at the house meeting before, or a thing I said when inviting her to live with us. I hate her for having completely unreasonable expectations of me. I hate her for not considering my feelings in any of this. I hate her for being wounded
when I was trying to take care of my own needs for once. I hate her for loving me, for wanting to possess me, for embodying everything I'm trying to escape. And most of all, I hate her because I feel guilty. I've smashed someone's already fragile heart to bits. Chapter 35, excerpt from Belle's journal.
This experience has been, to put it lightly, an emotional roller coaster. When I arrived, I felt as though for the first time in my life, I was free to be me, away from the judgment and potential disappointment of my family. So on the second night, when I told Neil it wasn't working for me, it was a combination of feelings. I felt like I was disappointing him and not contributing the way he wanted me to. And it felt like he and the other girls didn't want me there. I was also fucking confused that there were different rules for different people, and it threw me. Why is he allowed to kiss others in front of me and not the reverse? I was disappointed that I wasn't getting to do what I wanted with him, fuck him senseless. After all, that's why I came. Then the Anne drama happened tonight. I could understand where she was coming from, but it was frustrating. I could see she had some deep-rooted feelings for Neil, so why did she put herself in this situation? After the conversation with Reed, Nicole and I tried to tell Anne not to come to the play party. We told her that she would get hurt if she came. I'm going to assume she was thinking, if I do this and go along with it, Neil will be happy with me and I will get what I want out of the situation. Basically, she decided to hurt herself and go against everything she believed to get the guy. The whole scenario just bloody confuses me, to be honest. How did she get those feelings for Neil? And how the hell did he not see them? That whole situation blew up and I was happy to leave, albeit somewhat begrudgingly. I could tell he wasn't into it, and I still went along with it. He never needed me to make him hard before. Initially, I thought maybe it was the situation of being surrounded by people. Then it got obvious. He was doing something he either wasn't enjoying or didn't want to do, which is okay. I'll admit that I really didn't want to go into that room where Anne was afterward. God, nothing felt more daunting and emotionally fucked up than to go into that room. But he pleaded with me, so I went. And yes, I did plant a fake smile on my face. I felt awkward and like a bully. I was the bad guy, and that is so against my nature. I don't go out of my way to hurt people or be selfish, and I did. I felt very, very scummy, especially in the car ride home. When no one was talking and I felt their anger, it was an oh shit moment. Anne came and spoke to me back at the house afterward. I so didn't want to talk to her. I had uncomfortable emotions, and I felt I had knowingly and willingly hurt her. That was a tough conversation. She just wanted to keep talking, and because I felt guilty, I listened and was there for her. She talked about being raped by her first boyfriend, and I asked her if Neil knew. She said no. I said Neil wouldn't have put her in the situation if he knew, and that she needed to get professional help, and that hiding it and pretending it didn't happen was obviously not helping her life. I'm in turn upset that I've not gotten what I wanted out of this, to jump his bones. But I gained other things and insight into myself. And I learned how sex is a massive part of who I am, most likely an addiction. And it causes me to do things or act in a certain way to get it. I need to work on removing it from its pedestal and not letting it be something that's all-powerful and consuming, as I believe that's an unhealthy place for it to be. I'm not wishing I hadn't come, and I guess I don't want to leave. I'm just attempting to accept that this situation is so very different from my expectations of it. Everything's so complicated. Four different people with four different sets of needs, and some people so unwilling to compromise. Everything is just a bit too much to handle all at once right now.
Chapter 36. After dropping Nicole off, we drive home in silence. As we trudge up the stairs to the apartment, each in our own personal hell, I think about packing my bags, stuffing them in the car, driving away, and leaving the girls there. That would be a fucking funny end to this group relationship. Just abandoning them. Got a wife and two other wives in San Francisco, Jack. I went out for a ride, and I never went back. I used to fantasize, when I was a teenage virgin, about being the only man on earth and every woman wanting to sleep with me. But now I think it would be a nightmare, having all those people competing and manipulating and creating drama, then hurting so many feelings whenever you choose to sleep with just one or two. You'd be murdered before getting a chance to enjoy yourself. Perhaps that's the price of making your fantasies a reality. You realize pretty quickly that they were more fun to imagine. A friend of mine, Tina Jordan, used to date Hugh Hefner, who's well known for living with multiple women. On their first date, as he was courting her with champagne and strawberries in his bedroom, his other girlfriends got jealous, came to the door, and started pounding on it. Then they stormed in, yelling at Hefner and Jordan. Throughout their relationship, Jordan says, even though he was technically polyamorous, Hefner often snuck around, cheated, broke the rules, and was almost always caught by his girlfriends. He seemed to enjoy the drama, she noted. Having women fight over him made him feel wanted. Maybe that's the type of guy who likes being the fulcrum. I need to talk to you, Anne says as the others disappear wordlessly to their rooms. Not right now, okay? I respond, avoiding eye contact. I walk to the bathroom, brush my teeth, and prepare for another night on the couch. None of us has had dinner, but I'm too emotionally exhausted to think about it. I just want to disconnect from everyone, be alone with myself. As I stand with my back to the open door, I brace myself for the kitchen knife in the spine or the hammer to the skull. Who needs to worry about Mexican cartels when you have jealous lovers around? They'll finish the job much quicker and with more enthusiasm. As I write this, there's a story in the news about a Nigerian man with six wives. He was attacked with knives and sticks by five of them for paying too much attention to the sixth. According to the article, the five disgruntled wives demanded that he have sex with all of them and then, quote, raped him to death. While washing my face, I sense Veronica's chilly presence behind me, casting an ominous shadow. Here it comes, the attack. Can we talk? She asks. It's an emotional attack, the most dangerous kind. And right now, I need time to myself before I say or do anything else I'll regret. Not right now, okay? She pivots wordlessly, bristles past me, and runs a bath for herself while I retire to my quarantine area on the couch and grab my computer to take notes. For me, the best way to understand what actually transpired in any given situation is to write about it until the truth emerges. As I'm typing, I hear the thud of Belle's heels on the floor behind me. I feel her drop down next to me. I sense her sitting there, falsely patient, waiting for me to look up. Irritation snakes through my body as I keep my head down. Now her hand is on my knee, sucking my heat, my energy, my soul, and leaving in their place just a cold, dark void. After an interminable minute, she speaks. I need to talk to you. I feel like I'm in a horror movie, trapped in a house full of zombies, and every few steps I take, one's jumping out at me from around the corner. But instead of saying, brains, they're saying, I need to talk to you. And in a way, it's the same desire, to consume my brain. Perhaps the latter is even worse. At least I can run away from zombies. There's no escaping from emotions. But I can try. Can we talk later? I need some time to myself right now. I guess rationally, I understand that, Belle replies. Irrationally, I don't. I will try not to let it hurt my feelings. Her words are needles of nonsense, poking my eardrums. How's this hurting her feelings? I mean, when do I get any alone time? It's insane. Is it okay if I cuddle with you while you write then? From now on, I'm off limits. I snap. I imagine Anne coming upstairs and seeing us. In fact, no one can touch me. I cross my hands in the air, forming an X for off limits. What was supposed to be a wild poly pod has turned into a fucking nunnery. She remains planted next to me stubbornly, so I stare at her with the full force of my irritation and anger, drilling it deep into her sockets, trying to drive her away. She came to get her feelings cared for, and instead, they're getting further demolished. Everything about this situation reminds me of the final months of my relationship with Ingrid, when her every needy touch and expression made my skin crawl. Set free to make my wettest dreams come true, I'm right back in the same situation, only it's three times worse. Can I just have one hug? Belle persists. These zombies have a weapon greater than flesh-ripping strength. It's called guilt. And so I lift my arms and let them encircle her, though my nerves itch and my heart pounds and every cell in my body flees in the opposite direction. Despite this revolt, I try to give her the affection she needs. As I do, I realize I have no idea what the boundary is between taking care of my emotions, wants, and needs, and taking care of the emotions, wants, and needs of others. It seems I'm always way off the mark in one direction or the other. After the hug of death, Belle pads away, content. I make the mistake of thinking that the nightmare is over, but 10 minutes later, like the scene after the end credits of a horror film, Veronica rises out of the water of the bath, hunts me down in the kitchen, and attacks. Belle just ordered Chinese food, but only for herself. How am I going to eat? What the fuck? Am I responsible for everyone's diet and nutrition now? She figured out how to eat before she met me. You're a big girl, I tell her. Figure it out for yourself. These women just don't stop going after one another. She shakes her head and says, "That was mean." Once again, she's right. Where there's reactivity, there's a wound, and I am overreacting to everything. That's when I realize this whole enterprise was doomed from the start. In my relationship with Ingrid, I felt trapped by her desires and needs, and so I absurdly deceived myself into thinking that somehow I'd feel more free in a house with additional women and additional needs. Polyamory, at least when I'm the fulcrum, is not the answer for a guy with enmeshment issues. Too many invisible nooses encircling me, tightening around me, choking me, killing my spirit. Maybe I'm neither mono nor poly, but just solo. I gather my strength, enter Belle's room, and ask her to add enough dishes to the order so everyone can eat. But 5 minutes later, she emerges and whines, "I can't connect to the internet. Now I'm technical support? Can't they figure anything out for themselves? Give me the phone number and I'll call them." How did Father Yod survive 14 wives? Or maybe he didn't, and that's why he died at age 53. I should call one of his wives and ask how he made those 105 relationships, according to the Gauss-Pepper formula, work. I get half an hour of alone time until the Chinese food comes. As I'm setting the table, Belle and Veronica walk in. "We talked, and between us, it's all good now," Belle says. "We decided that Anne needs to go back to Paris, and we came up with an idea together." "What's that?"